Welcome to the Millennium Centre to commemorate the 6th National Holocaust Day, and it's the first time that Wales has hosted this event. The theme of the evening is One Person Can Make a Difference, and it's a tribute to the rescuers, those who risked their own lives to save others. And those taking part this evening include people directly affected by the Holocaust and other atrocities. The programme also includes contributions by school children, in the hope that the young will ensure that the mistakes of the past are not repeated, that they will understand our responsibility to speak up for the oppressed, and learn that one person can make a difference. Speakers this evening include the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, the First Minister, Shadri Morgan, and the Chief Rabbi, Jonathan Sachs.
At the Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Israel, there is a broad walkway lined with carob trees, more than 600 of them. This is the Avenue of the Righteous. Each tree bears a plaque with the name of a Gentile who risked his or her life to save Jews from the Holocaust. These trees and these names have become a symbol of human decency in the midst of unthinkable evil. The 600 honored here are only a small representation of those that Yad Vashem calls the Hasidei Umot HaOlam, the righteous among the nations. As of the 1st of January this year, 21,500 people have been so honored. In the case of Denmark, the whole nation collectively. It is estimated that some 300 million non-Jewish Europeans lived under Nazi occupation during the Holocaust. Accordingly, the actions of this less than 0.1% of the population and of those who for varying reasons have not been honored become even more remarkable. Some such as Frank Foley, Varian Fry, Oskar Schindler, Raoul Wallenberg, André Crocombe saved hundreds or even thousands. Others may only have hidden someone for a few hours. They are all heroes. In the Jewish tradition, if someone saves a single life, it is though that person had saved the entire world.
Now we're about to see an extract from the film Weapons of the Spirit by Pierre Sauvage.
I am a Jew born in Nazi-occupied France. At that time, a spiritual plague was still sweeping throughout the Western world. It produced the Holocaust. The Holocaust that mutilated my family, burned my roots, wiped out one-third of my people. This was my mother's family in Poland before the war. They killed her mother, her younger brother, her sister, her brother-in-law, her little niece. And yet, my parents and I, and many others, were sheltered in a village in the mountains of France. I returned there to find out why. In the beginning, a few Jews made their way to this tiny corner of the world. And the peasants and villagers of the area took in the Jews who came. And the Jews kept coming. And the people of Le Chandon kept taking them in. Individuals, couples, families, the children, the elderly, people of all ages, those who could pay and those who couldn't. Jews without accents and Jews with accents. Doctors and merchants and intellectuals and homemakers. From Paris and Warsaw and Vienna and Prague.
It's on a train very much like this one that my parents arrived in Le Chambon-sur-Lignon in the fall of 1943. My mother was pregnant, and on March 25, 1944, a Jewish baby had the good fortune to see the light of day in a place on earth uniquely committed to its survival.
The Nazis had proclaimed a 1,000-year Reich and appeared triumphant. But for the people of Le Chambon, that was beside the point. Here, at one time or another, in the course of 4 long years, and throughout the area, some 5,000 Jews found shelter among some 5,000 Christians. That was me on that train a while back, revisiting Le Chambon. There, the peasants and villagers of this Huguenot community turned no one away, betrayed no one, attempted to convert no one. There was something to be done, and they just did it. No big deal. It was who they were. But I'm also here because earlier in the war, my parents had been part of the flood of refugees who had found their way to Marseille after France fell to the Nazis. Marseille, France's big port onto the outer world, the escape hatch from then an occupied collaborationist Vichy France, or so people hoped, the real Casablanca. Tonight, we also honor some Americans who cared and who also found their way to Marseille. Among them was a New York intellectual named Varian Fry, the first American to be honored by Yad Vashem as a righteous among the nations. For 13 months, Fry led the most successful private American rescue operation of those terrible years, ultimately helping to save some 2,000 people, many of them among the luminaries of Europe. Joining in this rescue effort was a young Virginian, a descendant of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who now lives in London and who joins us here tonight. I give you Charles Fernley Fawcett in Marseille.
We were from the promised land. Every refugee, their dream was to get to America, of course.
Varian Fry was the last man in the world you would have ever thought could have possibly done anything in the underground. I told Fry that I'd been an amateur wrestler. He said, "Oh, wonderful, I need you because you can stand there and get rid of anybody who's not supposed to be there." He didn't tell me who wasn't supposed to be there. Marseille was, it was a terrifying place, you know. We tried to keep as low profile as we could. People would tell another, and the first thing you know, we were the most well-known organization in town. But still, they thought of us as a refugee organization for, you know, giving them food and money to live on. And they had no idea that we were in this underground thing until much later. Gangsters mostly were in this area up above there, in the old port. But the gangsters were our friends, you know, most of the time.
What were some of your jobs?
Well, taking papers and food stamps and then escorting people to going down to get them and bring them into Marseille or taking them down to the frontier. Whatever I was told to do.
We were breaking the law. And we were what we were doing was absolutely against what the State Department was expecting people to do. But what could we do? We had to do it.
Some of our people were hiding up here.
There's a fountain here.
Oh, there it is here.
It was a good place to sit that made it look casual. The main thing you wanted to do, not to look too secret, you know.
There were a couple of bordellos where we hid them. That was the best place to hide them because then we could, the police didn't investigate much there. As Beamish said, the police didn't go there, they might find their commanding officer there. You know, I was a little bit involved with other Jewish organizations, underground organizations. One of them was a woman in Paris, and she said to me, are you still a bachelor? And I said, yes, why? She said, looked around to see if anybody was listening, and he said, I have these two young ladies that if you were willing to marry them, they're in different places, they could get, they're Jewish, and they could get out of camps. Would you be willing to do it?
So how many were there in all?
Six.
You had a trumpet with you in Marseille?
Well, yes. You know, in that extension of the third valve, I could hide messages and all. And nobody ever took you serious if you had a trumpet with you.
The American consulate didn't like us very much. And they kept telling us, you have to leave. You're rocking the boat. And we have to play ball with Vichy because that's the government of the country now. This horrible doorman was given instruction not to let them in, and he really meant it. And Bill and I took him around the corner one day and worked him over. I had a wrestling hold on him, and all the refugees were watching, and when we got around the corner, three or four of them had followed us, and they were watching. And we really gave him a working over. And from then on, he was much nicer.
Charles, a lot of people say, well, we didn't know anything. Nobody knew anything.
People were, if they didn't, then they couldn't read. I think people knew more than they pretended to. People close their eyes to what they don't want to see. Fry was really passionately committed to this thing. He was 100% idealist, you know. You don't find many people like that. And I was healthy and strong, and I thought, you know, I could make a difference. I don't know if I did or not, but anyway, it's a responsibility people have. And I think, really, we are supposed to be our brother's keeper.
In the course of his life, Charles Fawcett was not only to be an actor, a musician, a songwriter, a composer, an artist, an athlete, a socialite, a foreign legionnaire, a wartime RAF pilot and rescuer of British soldiers, but also a freedom fighter in many of the major hotspots of the globe. I am proud to call him my friend.
Prime Minister Tony Blair now making his way to the stage.
Nothing compares to the Holocaust. Not in the intensity of its evil. Not in the suffering of a people made to suffer precisely because they were a people. Not in the ghastly scope of its inhuman ambition. And in the combination of twisted ideas and wicked actions that for a time threatened to engulf our entire world. Here in Europe, home to so much culture and learning and civilization, it happened, and in the lifetime of my father. Today it seems unthinkable. Yet tonight, we think of it deliberately to remember. We do so to commemorate the millions who died in the Nazi onslaught. We do so to reflect on the victims of genocides more recent. We do so in order to rededicate ourselves to fighting racism and to embracing the tolerance of difference. And we do so in humble thanksgiving for the goodness that, despite everything, is in the human race. Friendship, solidarity, kindness, selflessness, love. It is in the times of the greatest evil and challenge that humanity shows most starkly the range of its character. The worst and most dark, from the Holocaust mass slaughter of the innocent, Jews, gays, the disabled, the dissidents, the gypsies, to all the petty, horrible acts of mean prejudice that provided the context in which Nazi ideology flourished. The indifferent, those who did not do the worst themselves, but who knew and shut out the knowing, who saw but refused to witness. And then the persons who made the difference, who in defiance of it all stood up and were counted, who, whether from a decision to be brave or just an instinct to do good, acted, helped, and saved. And just as it was the venom of racial hatred that created the gas chambers of death, so it was these acts of selfless endeavor that gave us the will to defeat the Nazis and to work for a better life in a better world. These people are the flame of hope we carry today, for they prove that in the end it can be done. And as we remember the horror, the agony, the merciless tyranny of the Holocaust, we remember that for all its force, it was not strong enough to overcome them, the ones who made the difference. And now, 60 years later, we live in a Europe at peace and in prosperity. That is the memorial to the Holocaust victims and their helpers. And this is our commitment, never, anywhere, at any time, to let it happen again.